1890s, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of far. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Fireside Chats.
How's it going, Higher Side Chatters? Drink a little drink, smoking a little smoke. From sunny San Diego, I'm Greg Carlwood, and as we analyze the lies from the power pyramid, awakening to the fact that when they're pushing one perspective, usually we find the opposite to be true. And one area where this is becoming increasingly clear is that ancient wisdom was not just different, but enlightening and superior, putting man more in tune with nature, more artistically and architecturally advanced, and also what is most likely the biggest reason for the campaign to destroy it. Ancient man's mindset greatly valued personal knowledge and saw no need for a privileged authority. Of course, the shadowy elite couldn't have that, but now centuries later, we're putting back the pieces and the big picture gets clearer every day. And one of the puzzle masters out there putting Humpty Dumpty back together again in a big way is today's guest, Richard Cassaro. He's a journalist, lecturer, Freemason, American expat, and the author of Written in Stone, Decoding the Secret Masonic Religion Hidden in Gothic Cathedrals and World Architecture. It's my pleasure to introduce a man who's digging up the plan. Richard, welcome to THC.
All right. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. I love that puzzle master. That was cool.
Yeah, I try to be creative with that. But thanks for being here. It is a real treat. I mean, again, this show, it was a listener's request that made me aware of your work. And I'm glad that I have been, because it seems like you're picking up architecture in the ancient world that isn't on other people's radar. And when you stack up case after case like you do, it really seems like we're talking about global knowledge to a degree that's pretty staggering, wouldn't you say?
Definitely, yeah. And it's something that it's always been with me. It's stuff that was always inside of me and coming outside of me now. And that's what I'm bringing to the table. And that's why it's fun for me, because it's who I am. It's not like I see something and I want to try to be that thing. It's stuff that's coming out that was always inside of me. Always looking at churches, wondering why they had those big three entrances. Ever since I can remember, I think I was 6 years old, one of my earliest memories in life, and looking at that and thinking, what does that mean? And being struck by it. Mm-hmm. And then here, you know, so many decades later, figuring it all out and putting it all together, I love it.
Nice. Yeah. I mean, when you can fight the temptation to get distracted by the hustle and bustle of life, the debt that's accumulating in your name, you know, paying bills, registering this, that, and the other, and all these things, you know, when you can actually extract yourself from that and look at the pressing questions that are occurring to you naturally and actually pursue that path, I mean, that's a beautiful thing.
Totally. Yep. That's totally right. I totally agree. It's once you can divorce yourself from having that 9-to-5 job, and once you can not have to worry anymore about when your next paycheck is coming, it all comes out of you. I know people have that during the day, you know, maybe for an hour or two, and that's excellent. When it's happening all day long, all week long, all month long, and all year long, it's just like an unbelievable awakening. And, you know, you feel overwhelmed by it, and it's so empowering as well.
Cheers to that, man. So tell us a little bit about this architecture and some of the aspects of it. I guess we should start with the triptych. This seems to be one of the premier things you're pointing out, and it seems to be everywhere. Tell us about this and why it's significant.
Okay. The triptych is something that I've always been interested in ever since I was small. The first time I've ever seen the triptychs, if you look at Gothic cathedrals and churches, the entrance, the west facade, the entrances to these buildings all have the triptych. It's a triple doorway. The doorway in the middle is slightly larger usually than the outer two doors flanking it. And I've always been drawn to it, always wondered what it was. As I got older, I learned about the Holy Trinity, you know, slightly older in my 7-8-year-old religious studies classes. They taught us about the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And I assumed that that's what the triptych stood for. But as I got a little bit older in my, you know, 13-14-year-old time, I started getting into Atlantis and UFOs and the Loch Ness Monster, all that type of stuff, and, you know, really getting into the mysteries of it. And slightly after that, a few years after that, I started to become friends with spiritual gurus and mystics and stuff. And little by little, I started to understand that the idea of Atlantis, which is this whole concept of a lost golden age in remote prehistory, where man was much more evolved, where civilization was much higher than it was today. And then this whole concept of the gradual decline of civilization. It's a complete opposite idea than what we're taught in school. You know, we're taught that from cavemen we became space travelers. Right. From idiots we became intelligent, highly sophisticated, highly technological, and much better off than we were. And what you have in this occult tradition, in this mystical tradition, in this inner tradition, is the complete opposite. The idea that a long time ago it was a golden age, and little by little the golden age sank and declined into the lower ages. You know, we have different if you look at history, you even see this in like the Greeks and the Romans, and in Hinduism you have it. For example, the Greek poet Hesiod, he talked about the golden age declining into the silver age, then the bronze age, then the iron age, you know, as time crept on. Mm-hmm. You have the Roman poet Ovid. He also talked about the golden age declining into the silver, then the bronze, and the iron age. In Hinduism, the concept of the ages is there as well. Satya, Treta, etc., etc. You've heard, I'm sure you've heard of the Kali Yuga age, which everybody says that we're in right now. And so, there's, you know, other connections to the Hopi, the Mayan, and other cultures across the world have this tradition. So it's really interesting because there's a historical reason to believe it, not just in these ancient cultures and not just in these philosophers, but also in this entire inner tradition of the occult and mysticism, and that, you know, that scholars have completely turned their back on. So I started getting into that at a very early age, and it really resonated with me. It was really something that I felt drawn to. And so how old was I? Late teens, I started traveling a lot, you know, going to Italy and different places in Europe. And I had started to realize that a lot of these three-door entrances were kind of everywhere, you know, not just in churches, but you find them also in mosques, in synagogues. You find them in Chinese architecture. You find them in Hinduism, in India, in Indian architecture. And so I started to realize, you know, it really doesn't stand for the Holy Trinity, because that's just one concept in one religious tradition. And so, besides, I had come already to realize that the Holy Trinity is, and I know a lot of people aren't going to like this, but it doesn't make any damn sense. Father, Son, Holy Spirit never made any sense to me. I've studied it. I've read the Bible so many times, and I'm a true philosopher. I mean, I even studied philosophy in college, and I've read all the traditions, and it never made any sense. The only way it made sense is Father, Son, Holy Spirit, if the Holy Spirit is a feminine. And right. So you have the Father, which is the soul, Son and Holy Spirit, the male and the female, the two opposites.
Mm-hmm. Some people actually say that the reason they use the Holy Spirit is it's a symbol for the removal of the feminine. And I think that's kind of an interesting perspective, because symbolically it's like a puff of smoke where the feminine used to be in the Trinity there. I don't know. I think that's kind of compelling.
That's it. I totally agree. That's exactly what it is. You have the middle door of the triptych, which is the Father, which is the eternal soul manifesting into the material world. And when the soul manifests into the material world, the world is made up of duality. And so that's the two opposite doors of the triptych. This is in every single ancient civilization. In my book, Written in Stone, I show it. I show how in each culture, the same concept of duality prevailed. The concept of duality, you'll find that people call it polarity and opposites. You find that in, bar none, every single ancient civilization on the planet. They all believed in the same. This is something that struck me as I was in college and then shortly after college. Every single ancient culture had the exact same wisdom. And it's impossible that archaeologists are not seeing what I'm seeing. Mm-hmm. Not only did they have the same pyramidal structures, a lot of them mummified their dead, same corbel vault architecture. And I show this on my website and my Facebook page and things like that in my book, photos. I mean, endless photos about the similarities. But they also had the same philosophical ideas. And the concept of duality that they all held was that physical existence, the material world, is made up of yin and yang. You have it in China. In China, the ancient China, they call it yin and yang. The two concepts of sun and moon. Okay. During the day and night, basically. During the day, it's light out and it's hot because the sun is shining. But at night, it's cold and dark. So you have this whole concept of opposites being symbolized by the sun on one hand and by the moon on the other hand. Mm-hmm. And that's the key. You have that in every civilization. They all talk about this duality and they all use the same symbolism of the sun and the moon, the day and the night, the light and the dark, the hot and the cold, to symbolize it, to express it. And one important part of it is the idea that everything in the universe is dual, including our own physical bodies, so that the right side of the body is the male, solar, warm side, and the female side, the left side, is the lunar, the yin side. You have this. This connects to Kundalini Yoga, which I know you're familiar with, Pitta and Ingala, Ida and Pingala. And you have this in every civilization. There's just different words for it. There's different names for it. But usually it's always symbolized by the sun on one side, on the right side, symbolizing the yang aspect, and the moon on the left side, the female side, symbolizing the yin aspect. And so that's, you have to remember the one thing, though. That's physical world stuff. And the soul is a spiritual being manifesting into the spiritual world. I mean, the material world, excuse me. So that's the middle door of the triptych. That's the eternal center. You know, when people say center yourself, find your soul within, be centered, balance. Balance between what? You know, if the concept of balance is between opposites. So that's the number three. You have three. The concept of the balance is the third door, the middle door, the balance point between the two outer doors, between the two opposing doorways. This is in Egypt. It's the ancient Mayans had it. In Peru, you have the Inca and all the pre-Inca cultures believed in it. And so this is what the ancient worldwide religion of the pyramid builders and the triptych temple makers, I guess you could call them, that was their religion. And I did some further research and realized that this is the inner tradition of Freemasonry. I mean, the whole concept of the triptych lives on in Freemasonry. And people talk about Freemasons, they came to take over the world. Well, Freemasonry in the past couple of hundred years has changed. It's been changed on purpose. It went through stunning transformations. But if you look toward the earlier Freemasons, they built the Gothic cathedrals. And the Gothic cathedrals all have triptych door entrances, triptych three-door entrances, and all the facade, all the architecture on the Gothic cathedrals explains what the triptych is, the duality, the reconciliation of opposites, the balance of the opposites, finding your soul within, who you are, the eternal you, the higher self. That's what the Gothic cathedrals were all talking about. That's what true Freemasonry is about. They knew the universal religion of all ancient civilizations.
Yeah, man. Wow. Those compelling connections. And it seems to make a lot of sense. I wanted to talk a little bit about that sun and moon wisdom that you had mentioned, because I find this part fascinating. Let me read from your blog. You have a post about this, and I just think this is a great introductory paragraph for this. But you say, a powerful ancient message is being communicated to us and hidden from us by the elite. The message comes from the sun and moon in our sky. The message or code was crafted billions of years ago by someone or something far more powerful and more intelligent than ourselves. Today's scholars and scientists have failed to recognize, let alone crack, the code of the sun and moon, but ancient priests and priestesses knew it well. Sadly, 2,000 years ago, organized religions like Christianity outlawed the sun and moon's wisdom. Luckily, secret societies like the Freemasons quickly arose to safeguard it. That is a very awesome paragraph and an intriguing perspective on ancient wisdom and the sacred knowledge of mystery schools. I mean, what brings you to the conclusion, I guess, that it is a form of communication?
Because the idea, you know, if you look at the coincidences of the sun and the moon, they're all very startling. Mm-hmm. Not just the symbolism, which I talked about, but let's go over it real slowly.
Sure.
You know, the sun is symbolic of the daytime. Okay. And the moon is symbolic of the nighttime. Now we have 12 hours in the day and 12 hours at night. That's exactly half each, you know. So you have a real strong coincidence there. So during the day, as I said, the day brings light, the night brings dark. Those are opposites. The light brings hot, the dark brings cold. Again, hot and cold are opposites.
Yeah.
The hot brings dry, but the cold brings moist. Those are opposites. The day symbolizes life. The night symbolizes death. Life and death are opposites. We think of life as good and we think of death as evil. Those are opposites as well. So that's all symbolism. That's pretty strong stuff right there. If you really think about that, you know, half of our lives are daytime and the other half are night. And half of our lives are ruled by one set of opposites and the other by the other set of opposites. That's just one aspect of it. Then there's more. If you look at and astronomers have always been perplexed by what they call this unbelievable coincidence. If you look at the sun and the full moon from Earth, they appear the exact same size in our sky. Mm-hmm. That's another major step forward to say, wow, this is more than just coincidence.
Yeah.
Because how could that, you know, our planet is situated in such a way that from our perspective, when we look at the sun and when we look at the full moon in the sky, they're the exact same size. So not only do we have the sun on one side ruling the day and the heat and all the yang stuff, and the moon on the other side ruling the night and the dark and all the yin stuff, but the two planetary objects, the two astronomical bodies, are the exact same size when viewed from Earth. That's not just a coincidence. There's something really strange about that. if you think about it, if you hear it, it might not be. But if you really sit one night and look at the stars and think about those opposites that I just told you about, and then think about that sun and moon coincidence, there's something up with that. And that's one of the things that that really struck me as being unbelievable. From a very early age, I've been considering all this. Not just me, all the ancient civilizations. If you look at the Egyptians, for example, the sun and the moon, it's very powerful stuff in ancient Egypt, in the ancient Egyptian religion. You have the whole left side of the body is the lunar side. The whole right side is the solar side. So they knew about this. This was something that their whole entire religion focused on. And this is something that's even known to Egyptologists. You could read this in modern books on Egyptology. So that's a few of the things that, shows you that there's something really going on here. And also in Freemasonry, the concept of the sun and the moon, very powerful stuff, strong tradition, all the symbolism. For example, if you look at the Masonic tracing boards, there's the two pillars of Jachin and Boaz. One of them is capped by the sun, Jachin. The other one is capped by the moon, Boaz. And that's major stuff in Freemasonry. The Jachin and the Boaz pillars, they symbolize the concept of duality. And all of the cathedrals, the Gothic cathedrals of Europe, have those massive twin pillars. If anybody's in front of the computer, just Google Gothic cathedrals and you'll see this. Two massive twin pillars, and one of them is the solar pillar and one of them is the lunar pillar. Jachin on the right and Boaz on the left. As a matter of fact, Chartres Cathedral in France has an iron plate of the sun above one pillar and an iron plate of the moon above the other pillar. And that's because the Freemasons, the true, good, noble, strong, powerful people, men who were safeguarding the ancient tradition, the ancient universal religion, encoded it into the cathedrals, into the architecture. Every single part of the architecture is explaining this lost ancient tradition. And so that's who the Freemasons really were. That's why when I hear people talking about the Freemasons today, it's okay, I understand. Yeah, you know, everything is corrupted. You know, every single schools are corrupted, universities are corrupted, the law is corrupted, the government's corrupted. Obviously, Freemasonry has been corrupted as well. But don't get confused and think that the Freemasons were founded because they were trying to start some new world order. That's garbage. That's total garbage. That'd be a big mistake for you to make, for anybody to make, because the Freemasons built those cathedrals, and I've deciphered the architecture in those cathedrals, and they were very spiritual people, higher self. They believed in the higher self. Everything that they did was to encode a message in stone for us, because they knew there would be a darker time. They knew that the only way to keep this wisdom alive wasn't to write it down on paper. You know, they encoded it in structures that to this day are still around. Those Catholic cathedrals are 1,000 years old.
Yeah.
These people deserve respect, man. Not for us to say, oh, the Freemasons, they're in charge of the banks. People are in charge of the banks. I know who, not the Freemasons. There's other people in charge of the banks and the IMF and all this other stuff, the pharmaceuticals, big oil. Sure, I see the conspiracy too. You know, I went out and lived on my own too and realized how there's no way to make it unless you, are going to work the rest of your life like a slave. But, don't get confused and think that the Freemasons are behind it. Maybe in the past 100 years, the whole thing, 200 years, there's been a corruption. And, you know, you could point to some Freemasons and say that the institution has been corrupted. Okay, that's fine. I don't have any arguments there. But to say that it was founded originally to be some type of instrument for the New World Order, I think you're making a big mistake. I think you're not paying attention to all this esoteric architecture, not just in the Gothic cathedrals, but in the castles and in the churches and other buildings that exist throughout the world. Yeah. I'm talking too much, Greg.
No worries, man. I kind of agree with you there. I mean, I've definitely had guests who are Freemasons who I think are super enlightening and intelligent, and obviously thereafter the real knowledge. It's obviously split in the conspiracy community when talking about the Masons. And it is kind of a popular thought in especially people who look at ancient civilizations and ancient architecture and look at this knowledge that we used to have. It's pretty popular to come to the conclusion that the Vatican Empire started trying to destroy this knowledge. The keepers of it formed secret societies to preserve it. And I can definitely see that thread. But when I look at who the Masons have always been, at least to my knowledge, which is fairly ignorant, I mean, whether you're talking about titans of industry or the forefathers of America, it almost is exclusively rich white men. And sometimes I'm curious if the same people who worked to destroy it in a mainstream way didn't just create the secret societies to preserve it for themselves. Yes, to preserve it, but not necessarily for humanity. I'm not sure. But you also mentioned the removal of the feminine. And Freemasonry definitely doesn't treat women all that well.
Well, this is fair. It's definitely fair to say. Again, what I'm looking at are the cathedral builders.
Right. From that perspective, yeah.
Yeah. Well, as I said before, you know, remember too, the Golden Age, you know, thousands of years BC, it's all getting worse and worse and worse. Even in my own short lifetime, you know, in the past 30 years, 40 years, I've seen such a decline. So imagine how much it's really declining over hundreds of years, you know, over a period of hundreds of years. So that's something that, you know, to keep in mind as well. I'm looking at the cathedral builders. I'm looking at most of the castles that also retain a lot of the esoteric wisdom. And so that's from my point of view, what the true Freemasons were. You know, when we get down to the 1700s, 1600s, 15, even the 1800s, that's where I think the major changes started to occur, in the 1800s.
Yeah.
And in fact, in one of my upcoming films, I've actually pinpointed it to a certain episode, the Morgan Affair. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
I heard you talk about it on a previous interview, and that was going to be one of my questions for you. Tell us a little bit about this, because this does back up the idea that there was a shakeup in Freemasonry, and this seems to be a catalyst for it.
Yeah, it was basically when I look at the Morgan Affair, it looks to me like it was a red flag,
like a false flag event kind of thing.
False flag, you know, we're in the 1830s here, more or less. It's tough for me to recall all the details because that's not the way my mind works. I try not to remember too much stuff because I don't want to keep too much stuff in my mind at one time.
I did write down some notes. I guess it was in the 1830s. Sometimes someone was going to reveal the secrets, I guess, this guy Morgan.
William Morgan was going to reveal. This is according to historians. William Morgan was going to reveal the secrets of Freemasonry. Okay. So then you have supposedly the Masons warned him not to do it. He didn't listen. He disappeared, and they blamed the Masons. They said, "Oh, well, the Masons must have killed him." And so they were brought to trial. They were exonerated of this supposed crime because the body was never found. And then according to historians, everybody got upset because it appeared that the judge was a Freemason and all the people at the trial were Freemasons and they let each other go. And so there was this huge backlash against Freemasonry and everybody got upset about at Freemasons and lodges were boarded up. People stopped attending meetings. People disavowed Freemasonry. They didn't want to be Freemasons anymore. And supposedly across the country, you had this whole shutdown of the system. There was no longer any Freemasonry, or it died down from what it was prior. And then this happened for about 20 years or 30 years. And it went through a kind of change. And this is interesting because it did go through a kind of change. And there was a drop off in the membership of Freemasonry. And then when it reemerged, I think it was in the 50s or the 60s, 1850s, 1860s, it was a completely different order. And that's something that's visible because all of a sudden from what's appeared to be a more mystical and loosely organized origin, it turned into a much more highly controlled and a much more, sort of American apple pie, 4th of July type of thing, what you see today, you know, which people join Masonry and they talk about the picnics and the fireworks and the fishing trips. And that's not what true Freemasonry is. You know, true Freemasonry is a mystical organization where people who are looking for something deeper than what religion can give you, that's where you go. That's where you used to go. Not, you know, you try to go there today, but you know, you get the fishing trip stuff and that's where the difference is. And I pinpoint the change to the Morgan affair. That's as far as my research goes. I'm still looking into it. I'm asking a lot of questions about it. I'm not 100% saying that this is the way it happened. But this is interesting to me. That's all. My real forte is symbolism. My real forte is looking at the ancient cultures, figuring out, showing the similarities between ancient cultures, showing how they all had the same belief systems, pointing to symbols that show the belief systems, and then finding the tradition, the same concept of the universal religion in true, authentic Freemasonry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's super interesting. And also, I mean, there are other researchers who talk about that shakeup, and I have never heard about the Morgan affair. That definitely could be it. Frederick, a friend of mine and previous guest we've had, he's done a lot of research on the Scottish Rite branch in particular, as he seems to think that they're responsible for a lot of the emptiness of Masonry, because for one of the newest chapters, and they've grown to become the biggest. So that's kind of an indication that they have help in breaking down the barriers of becoming a huge organization, and it seems to be devoid of a lot of the original information. So, I mean, it's definitely compelling. You also, I've heard you talk about in the past, there was a guy who wrote a letter to George Washington and said something about a cabal ransacking Freemasonry in Europe or something of that effect, right?
Yeah, I would have to check my notes, though, for names and dates and things like that.
Yeah.
But, I think it was Schneider. I forget, and I don't have access to anything right now. But, yeah, the whole, in a nutshell, the Illuminati, and we've all heard that name before, mm-hmm. There's information, and it's good, solid information, that the Illuminati arose and infiltrated the Masonic lodges little by little. A small faction, and they infiltrated, they took some of the wisdom, and what they did was they slowly took over the lodges. And this didn't happen in 5 or 10 years. This happened slowly over time. And that same group of Illuminati then crossed the Atlantic and came to America. And just as George Washington was dying of old age, he wrote a letter. And he said in the letter, I think it was to a man named Schneider, some unknown person of history. He said something to the effect of, "I've heard of the doctrines of the Illuminati. I've heard of the evil of the Illuminati and what they're doing in Europe, and I haven't seen any of that here in the Masonic lodges here, not yet, anyway." And I think he died about 6 months later. So that letter to me was a little bit of information that said George Washington wrote a letter saying he'd heard that the Illuminati was ransacking through the Masonic lodges in Europe, and he had not seen that coming to America yet. And this was in the late 1800s. Then, of course, the late 1700s. Then, of course, 40 years later, you had the Morgan affair, where all of American Masonry seems to have changed. Mm-hmm. So that's where that's another piece of the puzzle that I see that I'm putting together for my own curiosity. You know, that shows me that this Illuminati, it's the Illuminati that started in Europe that came to America, is responsible for the taking away the wisdom of Freemasonry and, you know, making it kind of a ruin, which is what I see of it today. I don't study a lot of Freemasonry today because I'm just not interested. To me, it's a jumbled mess, and I don't, you know, I'm more interested in the symbols of the Masonic tracing boards, which some of them come from the 1700s and the early 1800s, because those are more authentic. You know, the aprons, you know, the old fashioned aprons, symbolism on chairs, symbolism on swords, because that stuff is authentic. Because, you know, you could change the doctrines, you can change what people are talking about. That's what they did. They jumbled up the ceremony and they changed it all around. It's, you can still see pieces of wisdom underneath it, the duality, like I said, the duality and the transcendence of duality to find the higher self. This is the concept of the number three that Freemasonry is famous for. You know, the Freemasons all talk about the number three historically, and all the buildings of Washington, D.C. and all the buildings in the world have three symbolism. The whole concept of three, again, is the balance of duality to find the center, to find the inner self, the higher self, recognizing that you're not your body, recognizing that you're something much higher than that. You're an eternal soul incarnating as, you know, your body. And the soul is a god, by the way. And that's another piece of the puzzle that I see a lot of researchers and authors making a big mistake about. Mm-hmm. You know, according the higher power, a monotheistic deity, or, you know, that guy over there, he's got all the power. He's absolute. He's no. It's you. You're the god. You're the power. You're the eternal soul. You decided to grow a body, and you knew it was going to be temporary. When you die, you'll go back to your higher self.
Right.
You know, there's no person to follow. Don't ask for help from somebody else. It's all you. Believe in yourself. You know, your higher self, but you are the power. You have the power. And we've been divorced from that because, you know, the powers that be don't want us to know that. You know, this information is being hidden from us because it's a lot easier to make people slaves that way, to make them believe that they have to follow a doctrine rather than look inside themselves for the truth.
Mm-hmm. Well said, man. And that was something else I was going to ask you about. An area of research of yours that I found pretty compelling was the God Self icon. You've kind of explained what it might mean, but where do we see this encoded?
God Self icon, you know, I'm actually writing a book about it right now, and I'm hoping it's going to be ready in a couple of months. The God Self icon is just something that's been blowing me away for several years now. Every single ancient civilization had the God Self icon. It is a lost icon of a universal religion that existed in ancient times. The God Self icon is basically a human being with his two arms, his or her two arms outspread to the left and to the right, and usually holding parallel objects in each hand. Mm-hmm. And so again, you know, the left side of the body, the yin side, the right side of the body, the yang side, the pose is showing us that duality of left and right is important here. And when you extend both arms to the sides, then the spinal column and the head are your middle. So if you think about it in terms of the triptych or the three doors, the left hand holding that object is the left side, the yin side. The right hand holding that object is the yang, right side. And your brain and your spinal column are your center, are the God part of you. And I'm still researching it, even though I put together collages and I wrote articles about it and my website, and it's also a chapter in my book, in Written in Stone. But I'm still, I mean, there's a lot more to study about it. The rebus of 16th, 17th, and 18th century manuscripts is also a symbol of the God Self. You know, in one hand, the rebus holds the sun, and the other hand, the rebus holds the moon. The left mm-hmm. is the moon, the right is the sun. You have the God Self icon also on cathedrals and Gothic cathedrals, churches. It's carved usually holding twin animals on both sides. And that's the animal self. You know, as I said, we're an eternal deity. We're a god manifesting into the material world. And how we manifest is in the form of an animal. You know, we are animals. That's the naked truth of it. Yeah. And that's why the god self holds twin animals, because in order to manifest into the world, we have to put on an animal's body. That's a big part of the occult. I don't hear anybody talking about too much. You know, we are animals. We're a god manifesting as an animal. And that's why you have the two animals on either side, because we put on the clothing of an animal. And that's what the god self is telling us, that, you know, in order to incarnate into the world, we had to put on this clothing of this animal clothing, this clothing of flesh. And so part of the meaning of life is to find the truth, find the middle balance, find the true center, and transcend the dualities and find the higher self. Remember who you are, you know. Yeah. Know thyself. To thine own self be true, right?
Right, right. I thought the list of pictures you have on your website of all the times this God self icon shows up, I mean, it's really, really interesting. And the archetype is always the same. The animal's different, but it's the same two outstretched arms. And the two animals that I noticed the most seem to be snakes and lions, or some kind of big cat. And I thought that was really interesting, because when people do certain psychedelics like ayahuasca, they always seem to say they see snakes. And then also the green lion in alchemical writings was usually what they used to refer to marijuana. And I don't know if you've explored that component or if that's even a component. Maybe I'm stretching, but when you get into developing the higher self and the third eye, I mean, these things dovetail into psychedelics pretty well.
Absolutely. Yep. Absolutely, Greg. Yeah. And it's very, very interesting. You know, everything you said is absolutely correct. I'll just add that, you know, for example, the twin serpents on both sides, a common theme in almost every single ancient all the great centers of civilization in antiquity had those twin serpents on both sides. And so, you know, and the serpent has a lot of different meanings, and it depends on what context you're looking at it. But, you know, it could have a negative connotation. I mean, snakes are serpents are the lowest thing. They crawl on their bellies. You know, the women are usually afraid of serpents, right? Mm-hmm. And so they have a negative connotation. People are usually scared of them as they're scary. They're the evil and that type of thing. They're also very powerful, and they symbolize eternal life because they're able to slow their skin. And so they never really die, you know, because they always just take off that layer of skin. It's like a soul reincarnating constantly, you know. The soul is the serpent and the skin are the bodies that you just shed every time that you're done with them. There's a lot there that I'm putting some of it in my book, and I'm exploring other parts of it. I have ideas, and it's hard to, because I like to back everything up with images and photos and quotes. I don't like when authors just talk about things and just we're supposed to believe that at face value.
It's true.
I like it when, you know, I show photos and then I show another photo from some other culture, and then I show something from, you know, the 17th century and then another thing from the 18th century, and then a cool quote from like Joseph Campbell or Alan Watts, you know. Yeah. And it's like ties it all together, and like, wow, this, I always look at my writing or my blog articles or my book like I'm presenting evidence in court, and I have to convince a jury that this is true. I give lectures in Masonic halls. And every time at the end of every lecture, somebody gets up and says, that's the best lecture I've ever seen. It was like you presenting evidence in court. And that's important to me, because I got to convince myself of it first.
Right.
And if I'm not convinced of it, I'm not going to try to convince anybody else of it.
Well said, man. And I do think that the serpent symbolism, you're right, it is so pervasive everywhere. And I think you make a compelling case about the secrets going into secret societies, but, you know, once they were up above the surface, and it seems like the Vatican and some of the huge dynasty religions wanted to snuff that information out. And maybe the Vatican went after the religions and the Illuminati went after the secret societies, and together their goal was to weed it out. But I also find it compelling that one of the biggest stories in the Bible, Adam and Eve and the serpent, I mean, if we take the idea that the Vatican was responsible for removing a lot of this knowledge, I mean, you can look at that story right there, and they're basically, the whole point of the story is stay away from the tree of knowledge. I mean, how funny is that, that it's one of the primary stories in the Catholic Bible, and they're telling you right there what they want to do, separate man from knowledge. But it's not them. It's God that wants that, you know? It's kind of funny.
Yeah, there was a point in my life where I just stopped everything with Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And it was a very early time, thank goodness, where I just cut it. I just said, you know, I'm not getting anything out of the Bible. I've read it so many times. I'm just not getting anything out of it. And, you know, Judaism, it all stems from Judaism. And I don't really see that as being a highly spiritual religion. And a lot of people look at, oh, there's this esoteric. But why should I bother going through all the esoteric, cutting through all the exoteric to try to find the esoteric when I can just easily go to Hinduism, Buddhism, and Taoism in the East and find it right there on the surface?
Yeah.
So it's interesting, yes, to go through the Bible and try to figure out what they're saying. Yeah, I guess that, you know, I did that for a little while. I got bored of it because I would just rather read the brilliant and powerful writings of the East and just get it right there. And, you know, it's right there on the surface. You know, there's no digging. There's no, you know, there's no trying to have to figure out what the secret meaning is. That's why I put those books. I put the Bible down. I put the Quran down. I've read the Quran too several times. Mm-hmm. And I actually liked it better than the Bible. But, yeah, the Mosaic religions, the monotheistic religions, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, for me, they have nothing to offer. For me.
Yeah.
For me.
Yeah. I think they're for the birds. So to look at this architecture, how can we explain cultures on every major continent and all these different areas across the globe having the same architecture when they aren't supposed to have been communicating? How could they communicate without modern technology? Can we solve that mystery?
Yeah, that's first off, you know, the writing, the similarities that I show, my main goal is to show that all of these cultures shared the same wisdom. Mm-hmm. Okay, if that's to me, that's the most important thing. They all shared the same religion, the same universe. I call it a universal religion. It's perennial wisdom fits, sacred science fits, whatever it is. It was a very powerful teaching, you know, esoteric tradition, whatever, to find the higher self between the duality. That's the key right there. You're an eternal being manifesting in the material world. That's it. Okay. The second part is just your question right there. How the hell did all these cultures have the same? That's the next part, okay? So once I figured out that they all had the same symbols and teaching and et cetera, I said, okay, now what is the meaning of this? Now there's two explanations. Diffusion, which is it all started in one place and then slowly moved across the world to the next place. Or you could look at it like there was, as I was saying before, a golden age. Okay, there was a time when all the cultures were united,
right?
And they called it Atlantis, or you could say that Atlantis was a continent in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. It sank beneath the seas. Survivors fled to different parts of the world, taking their wisdom with them. That's why you have pyramids, triptych temples, mummification in different parts of the world, like China, Egypt, in Mexico. So there's a lot of, there's these ideas. The inner tradition, if you're going with the occult tradition, and that's what I like to do. I like for my ideas to stay along those lines. You know why? Because for hundreds and hundreds of years, intelligent people have been following that tradition. And that's why I try not to use words like a matrix, you know, the matrix. I know it's a big popular word nowadays. It's fine. It's cool. It's good. People are waking up. I love it. But for me, I like to stick to life is a dream. Why? Because that's what the tradition, the occult tradition, the inner tradition, stick with what people have been talking about for centuries. Because then we can all sort of play off the same table, you know, we could all play off the same. But anyway, the concept is that we're all dreaming that of life. That's what when the soul manifests into the material world, it's like this God having a dream. Mm-hmm. And you find that everywhere. I mean, Rumi talks about it. Shakespeare, there's a famous line about all life being rounded by sleep. You know, dream was such stuff that dreams are made of. Life is what such stuff that dreams are made on. Something like this. Row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. Merrily, 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 life is just a dream. You know, there's plenty of stuff on my website. Just type in Google Richard Cassaro and dream, God, stuff like that. You'll find it. Lots of quotes, lots of information about that. But anyway, getting back to what we were talking about, there's this whole a tradition that I think we should stick to, which says that there was an ancient golden age. Some philosophers link it to Atlantis. Some thinkers just don't link it to anything, just call it a tradition. But they say that there was this golden age of Atlantis, and they say that the people in Atlantis were in touch with their divine self. Plato talks about it. He says the reason Atlantis fell was because exactly, he says, the people that lived in Atlantis lost the connection with the divine within them. Mm-hmm. And to me, it's just basically they forgot that they started to become more and more attractive to the material part of life. And they forgot that they were divine entities. They forgot that they were divinities. And so that slowly dropped off. Another part of the teaching says that the third eye, the Atlanteans had the power of the third eye. And that shrunk down to what today we call the pineal gland. And I talk about that in my book and my research tremendously because it's one of the main symbols of Freemasonry. Not only do you have the Jachin and the Boaz pillar, but at the top of those two pillars form the bottom parts of a triangle. And the apex of that triangle formed the inside the apex. Inside the triangle is a giant luminous eye, a centered eye. And that's the third eye. And that's clear, you know, and that's something that I've been talking about and writing about for years now. And that's, again, part of the ancient tradition, part of the occult, part of Freemasonry. It goes back to Atlantis. The concept of the third eye goes back to Atlantis. They called it the mind's eye, the inner eye. Whereas the two physical eyes see outward, the spiritual mind's eye, the third eye, sees inward at the inner soul. It's how you recognize the higher self. It's how you see that you're a divine being and not just the animal that you see in the mirror.
So
again, talking too much, right?
No worries. So I guess I would ask, you know, now everything today in today's world is all jumbled up. There's no real preservation of that golden era culture. Or, I mean, is there? Are there pockets of tribes in the Amazon and Peru that you think perhaps could have been undisturbed that still hold the same tenets and principles of the golden age?
I don't think so.
No, it's all gone.
Yeah, I think so. The closest we can come to it at this point is what I'm trying to do with my research, which is show all the similarities and all the parallels between cultures on different sides of the oceans, like the Egyptians and the Mayans, the Egyptians and the Inca and pre-Inca cultures of Peru, the cultures that existed in present-day Cambodia and Indonesia, and the cultures in the New World like the Mayan and the Aztec and things like that. Mm-hmm. China, you know, ancient China's culture, etc. You know, there's tremendous similarities, and that's, I think, the closest that we'll come to the lost wisdom. And again, you know, everything's corrupt these days, including the universities. The universities, right, the way they set this up, there's not a professor there who's hiding anything. He just wants to keep his job, you know. He wants to keep his job. He's not really interested in teaching something that is not part of the curriculum, you know.
Right.
I learned when I wanted to become an Egyptologist when I was in my early 20s, and I talked about Atlantis, and they said, no, we don't talk about Atlantis here, son. And so that's what I sort of said to myself, well, I'm going to go out and find evidence of Atlantis, and I'm going to show you guys that, you know, there's it existed, or that all the civilizations of old had the same wisdom tradition. And where did it come from? It must have come from an Atlantis-type culture or a higher golden age civilization. And, you know, civilization must be deteriorating. It's not getting better. It's deteriorating, you know, century after century. Age after age, it's getting lower and lower. And by the way, there's going to be a time when it completely collapses, and then it will begin to ascend again. So it's not just a downward cycle. It's a complete cycle. It goes down, you know, it goes down, and then it goes up again. And then it goes down, and then it goes up again. So, you know, we're in the down cycle. We're probably scraping the bottom almost. That's the way I see it.
It is an ebb and a flow, and I do love that perspective that we devolved from greatness rather than ascended from apes, because like I mentioned in the intro, it does seem like every time we're taught something and it's drilled into our heads aggressively, the opposite seems to be true. So, and that would be a perfect example of it. We're told we evolved from these primitive apes and that we have been marching on this steady incline towards progress and the pinnacle of human development. And meanwhile, we're uncovering all these ancient things that seem to point to a complete flipping of that script, and that it seems more like a humanity's timeline long game of telephone, where as we get further away from this original seeding of knowledge, we lose more and more and more of it, and now we're just fumbling around in the dark trying to figure it all out again.
Yeah, that's it. And as you look at these ancient monuments, you know, like Stonehenge, the Great Pyramid, I mean, there's a ton of monuments around the world that are unbelievably sophisticated. And for grown men and women to look at these monuments and sneer and say, oh, the ancients could have easily done that, I mean, that's unbelievable. I'm not saying they had higher technology necessarily. I think they were more spiritual beings. I think that they were, you know, they had much more power than we do. Mm-hmm. You know, we're disconnected from the source. We don't know our center. We're unbalanced. We're sick. You know, they weren't. They think of them, think of the people that built Sacsayhuaman in Peru or the Great Pyramid or Stonehenge as a group of Buddhas or Christs, you know, because that's what they were. And that's where people, I think, are making a mistake today. Oh, you know, this ancient advanced technology. I don't like that, really. It doesn't resonate with me because it doesn't fit in with what I see as being a golden age in the past. And I don't believe that the golden age necessarily had the machining technologies. That's the way we look at it today, because that's the only way we can comprehend it, you know. But right, the whole concept of a golden age, I think, and if you read in the writings of Plato and a lot of the other philosophers, not just Plato, by the way, a lot of philosophers talked about Atlantis, and they were higher spiritually. And so when you have when you're in touch with yourself, that's the whole concept of the Jesus story, the Christ story, and all the Osiris stories, and the Mithras, and all the sun gods of history. You know, those are they're examples for the masses of what you can do. You can be a Buddha. You can be a Christ. You are a Buddha. You are a Christ. You have that power within you. It's just a matter of finding it, finding the balance, striking the balance of opposites, transcending the opposites, finding the center within, finding your higher self. Those people that built those monuments were all spiritually centered. They were all Christs and Buddhas, or approaching Christs and Buddhas. You know, we could call them bodhisattvas, or we could call them enlightened beings that were not necessarily at the level of Buddha, but, you know, a lot closer than we are today, who, you know, we take pharmaceuticals, we live as slaves because we have to work, and we eat food that's horrible and genetically modified and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I don't have to go through the line. You know basically what kind of world we're living in.
Right. But, I mean, that is super interesting, and it could be that the drive to advanced technology is to fill the hole left by removing this component of natural knowledge, because I guess it didn't seem like so pressing to them when they were whole beings. When they went through the inner journey, they didn't have this need to tinker too much on the outside, although they did have some building technology, of course, because we look at the structures and we're just like in amazement of how they did that. But as far as travel and things like, you know, obviously computers and mechanical things, I'm not so sure how that all worked out. I guess another possibility I entertain is that obviously the ancient aliens idea is huge, and that this knowledge came from a third party somehow, and maybe that could also tie into the Atlantis civilization. But I'm also compelled by the idea that if there was a third party that kind of got this information to the cultures around the world, I wonder if it wasn't some type of spiritual or multidimensional communication from being in a higher state of mind.
I totally think that's possible. I really do. I think, you know, anything is possible. And that's a very interesting idea. And I don't see why that can't be.
And Richard, I guess that kind of gets us towards the end here. I mean, I think you're doing great work. I don't know anyone else drawing attention to these particular design elements around the globe. You find so many of them in so many places, and you're stitching back together the mindset and philosophy around those elements, and I think it's great stuff. But I guess before I cut you loose, remind the people about your book and website so they can check out a little bit more what you got going on.
Thanks a lot, Greg. That was, you know, I know that that came from your heart, and I really want to tell you something from my heart too, that what you're doing is just as important, if not more important. You're trying to get people to wake up also. You're trying to bring new bits of information from new authors and writers and stuff like that, and you're allowing people like me a platform to speak and talk about what they think. I think that's tremendously important. It's hard. It must be hard what you're doing. I'm sure you're not making $10,000 a week, and not that that's so important, but you know, right. You know what I'm saying. It's got to be a struggle, and keep doing it. Keep going strong. The book is called Written in Stone. You can get it at my website, richardcassaro.com or deepertruth.com. I'm also writing a second book. It's called The Missing Link. It's about the God Self icon found worldwide, which is a spinoff of an article in the Written in Stone book. And so, yeah, that's pretty much it right now. And I've got other things coming up on the horizon, including some films and some other articles for my website and a couple of more books. And so I'll keep you posted. And Greg, I really thank you very much for having me on. And I really mean that. I had a great conversation with you. I think you're a wonderful guy.
Oh, thanks, man. I do appreciate the kind words. And I agree. I had a great time, too. You know, keep doing what you do. Take care of yourself out there. And maybe I'll see you in Spain sometime.
All right, Craig. You got a standing invitation, okay?
Oh, wow. Thanks. All right, man. Take care.
All right. Take care, Greg.
There we go, people, brushing the dust off several aspects of our buried history, and I couldn't help but note the similarities between the triptych, or the tri-arch, and the tritone. I think these are two sides to a related coin. But I guess I've been so into the ancient wisdom lately because of this Armenia tour, but also, Richard Merrick thought that show was great. And by the way, please share the show if you can while I'm out of town and I can't do it myself. You know, I really don't ask for that very much, because usually I just posted a few places and let the chips fall where they may, but it would be helpful while I'm gone to kind of spread the word, if you'd be so kind. I'm really starting to settle in on my thoughts about the past and how these pieces fit over the last couple of shows. I hope you are too. And today, Richard's work is a big component of those thoughts for me. I really loved the first hour, and in the Plus show we talked about the current state of things, the soul-crushing 9-to-5, the lack of internal reflection and journeying, and how it's screwed so many of us up today. Also how, in Richard's words, Hollywood sets the tone for this life, and the role of professional sports is to eat the clock. I think that's such a good way of putting it. Take the people away from enlightenment, and then it's a race to see if they can rediscover it before they die. But who has time for psychonautic introspection when the game's on? I get it. We talk about the struggle to trust yourself and live the dream, the traps that have been set for us that we can get caught up in, the tentacles of the conspiracy squid that bother Richard most, and positive solutions to work towards wiggling free from their clutches, Richard's journey expatriating to Spain, all kinds of good stuff. So there will be a bit of delay between this and the next episode. I am still on the tour. Who knows how I'll return in what state, but hopefully I'll be ready to get back to it and churn out some more good shows. 3 left in the month of August. I have them booked when I get back. As long as there's no rescheduling or anything, we should be good. So take a lesson from Scar from The Lion King and be prepared. I'm getting out of here for now. I've done my part, so it's your move, destroyers of ancient knowledge and builders of the 9-to-5 paradigm. Your frickin' move.
Well, I wonder what it's like to be a rainmaker. I wonder what it's like to know that I made the rain. I saw it in boxes with little yellow tags on everyone. And you can come and see them when I'm done. When I'm done. Well, I wonder what it's like to be a superhero. I wonder where I go if I could fly around downtown, yeah. From some other planet, I'd get this funky high on the yellow sun. Boy, I bet my friends will all be stunned. They're stunned. Yeah, yeah. Straight up, what did you hope to learn about?
poncho. I wonder what I'd do if they just did all what I said. I'd shout out in order, I think we're on this Miami song. Boy, don't make me wanna change my change it all.